You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Thursday, April 15th, 2021. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, member of the editorial board at Dissent Magazine, worked in the labor movement for 23 years as a strategic campaigner, Rich DeSelson, on the Bessemer Amazon Union Drive failure. Also on the program today, House Committee approves D.C. statehood. The bill will be voted on next week in the House. Meanwhile, Republicans reportedly to pretend to offer an infrastructure bill to counter Joe Biden's bill. House and Senate Democrats unveil a bill to add four justices to the Supreme Court. H.R. 40. A bill to create a reparations process passes its House committee. And a Texas bill would send parents to prison if they okayed transgender care for their kids. The FEMA funeral program has nearly 1 million calls on day one of its operations. Representative Betsy McCollum introduces legislation to block Israel from using U.S. aid to destroy Palestinian homes. And Romney and Sinema team up to push an $11 minimum wage, the 55-week streak of jobless claims, higher than the Great Recession peak ends this week, with 576,000 new jobless. And it is debt reveal day. Debt reveal day is activists from more than 45 universities across the nation will share their findings and discuss strategies to leverage debtor power into structural transformation of higher education. These institutions will be revealing the amount of debt that they're carrying of their students. Welcome to the program. Sorry about the technical difficulties up front. Joining me as always, Emma Vigeland. Hello, Emma. How are you?
I'm doing well. Good job getting through some of those technical glitches. I might have just frozen, so I guess practice makes perfect for you.
Indeed. Yes. No.
Nothing new to Sam.
Well versed. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. There we go. Well versed at the well practiced in the technical difficulties, still living in the era of the pandemic and still doing the show differently than we would than optimally. Nevertheless, here we are. It is Thursday. And let's jump right into this clip. I just want to point out that we still had 576,000 unemployed who filed for unemployment this week. Still, you know, horrible numbers. But we are down from where we've been on a 55-week streak where unemployment numbers were greater than that of the Great Recession. And I don't want to say that's an achievement, but it is at least a sign that perhaps we have turned the corner. Now, of course, the flip side of that is part of that could be a function of the fact that we have opened up more across the country. And as such, we are seeing surges around the country, including New York, in terms of new infections. And so, you know, the race between the vaccinations and the infections continues. There is the B116, I think it is, strain, and then other variants that are more contagious than the, I guess they called it the wildfire COVID-19 that we were first subject to in this country. And these numbers are rising, and still it's a problem. And the real question is just, I mean, it doesn't seem like we can now slow this train of opening up, but I think they raised the curfew or the closing of bars in New York State to midnight. I haven't been to bars in quite a while, so it's not that big of a deal from my perspective, but it is going to promote more infections.
I don't know when I'll feel comfortable going to a bar. I can't even believe that bars have been open in any capacity at all.
In 6 months, we're going to look back on these like 2 or 3 months, and we're either going to be saying that we dodged a bullet in many respects, or we're going to be saying, like, you know, we should have been able to hold on for another 60 days and waited until we had hit some type of critical mass in terms of the number of vaccinated. But we shall see. Fortunately, we are not seeing the same. We are seeing an uptick in some instances in deaths, but we are not seeing necessarily the same rate relative to infections. And part of that is because the most vulnerable people in our society, most of them have gotten vaccinated. So we will have a better sense of that in the coming weeks. In the meantime, in the Senate, we still have confirmation hearings going on for various positions. This was a fun one. Here is the Senate Judiciary hearing. Confirmation of Kristen Clark. She is the Assistant Attorney General nominee. And John Cornyn grills her, and he thinks he's got a gotcha here. And apparently the staff at the John Cornyn's office, not necessarily...
not the brightest staff in the Senate.
I mean, it certainly appears like they don't seem to be very diligent. Here is this exchange.
Well, maybe there's a misprint, but I'm sure you can clear it up for me. Dating back to your days when in school, when you seemed to argue that African Americans were genetically superior to Caucasians, is that correct?
No, Senator. That I believe you're referring to an op-ed that I wrote at the age of 19 about the bell curve theory, a racist book that equated DNA with genetics and race. As a Black student at Harvard that time, we took grave offense to this book. It was co-authored by a Harvard professor. We did a number of events to speak out against the book, and this op-ed opened with a satirical reference to the statement that you just noted. Contemporaneous reporting by the campus paper made very clear that this was not a view that I espoused. What I was seeking to do was to hold up a mirror and put one racist theory alongside another to challenge people as to why we were unwilling to wholly reject the racist theory that defined the bell curve book.
So this was satire?
Absolutely, Senator.
Where was that published?
In the student paper, the Harvard Crimson. And there is contemporaneous reporting from that time, from that day, that makes clear that these were not views that I espoused, Senator.
Whoop. Well, where do I go from here?
We need to have a office meeting, everyone. You got to say, I mean, you know, for a piece of satire to function that well, I don't know when she was in college, but, 10, 15.
The Harvard Crimson, ever heard of it?
10, 15, 20 years ago. I don't know when she was in college, but that's pretty impressive to have a piece of satire that is still working. 20 years later, 10 years later, it is certainly effective. I think Cornyn saw the absurdity maybe of the bell curve at that point. There's a lot of people, I think, who should be embarrassed about their involvement of the bell curve.
Well, at least her opposition and her protest to a Harvard professor being involved in those writings and authoring it, that has aged incredibly well. What will continue to age well is John Cornyn's look of befuddlement as he shuffles his papers, being like, damn, the cross-examining plan I had for the next few hours kind of out the window. So I'm just right. going to reiterate, go through my mind. What kind of questions can I ask? What paper was this?
Can I still go through the righteousness that I had planned and the complete offense I was going to take and tie this into Black Lives Matter and the violence on the streets and sort of imply that maybe, look, there's nothing wrong with our policing in this country.
And he wasn't prepared. Yeah. He wasn't prepared to kind of nitpick her definition of satire. That would have been Ted Cruz, his Texan counterpart, would have been prepared in that way. John Cornyn isn't as bright, unfortunately, as the swarmy Ted Cruz.
Well, and kudos to her for being prepared for that question. I am familiar with the. With the experience of having written something satirical and having it be held against you. And in my instance,
right.
It took a little longer for the truth to win out. But congratulations to
at the
Kristen
hands
Clark.
Of a disingenuous right winger each time. It's
indeed.
Some
indeed.
Parallels there.
All right, we're going to take a quick break, and when we get back, we'll be talking to Rich Yselson about the Bessemer Amazon union drive. We'll be right back after this. Hey, folks, just a reminder, Sunset Lake CBD, sunsetlakescbd.com. They are having a special 420 sale. Now, Matt was completely wrong, it turns out, about 420. Matt the other day was saying that 420 was about like that was the time where it was like socially appropriate, apparently, to get high. Well, and yeah. You're wrong, Matt. I'm shocked by this. But it turns out that was the legislation in California to first, I think, legalize or decriminalize pot. That's what I understand now. So wrong, dude. Meanwhile,
I don't know if you're right about this.
It just happened to be 420, or did they name it 420 because that was already an established number in the pot community?
Well, I'll tell you what is an established number in the pot community. That is 30% off for the coupon code 420 at sunsetlakecbd.com. Sunsetlakecbd.com, we've talked about them past. Obviously, they've been sponsoring the show for at least a year at this point. And 30% off of their tinctures, which have been a huge boon to my ability to sleep, their gummies, their hemp flower, which has been a huge boon to Matt's different smoking practices, their chocolate fudge, which has been not so much a boon to my willpower, but they have CBD infused chocolate fudge. And they have all sorts of other CBD products. Their products are great. I've told you before, they pesticide free. They use integrated pest management. It's a farm up outside of Burlington that used to exclusively provide dairy to Ben and Jerry's. And now they diversified, and they're a mostly employee owned company. They just added another employee to the ownership of the company. And between now and April 23rd, if you use code 420, the number 420, for 30% off. They also are introducing CBD dog biscuits. They blended their CBD oil with three simple ingredients, peanut butter, pumpkin, and oat flour, to create delicious biscuits designed to comfort your four-legged friend. The treats each have 5 milligrams of CBD and contain no artificial flavorings or sweeteners. That sounds all actually it's weird, but I would eat that. I would eat peanut butter and pumpkin and oat flour and CBD.
Sure you would.
I would. That sounds actually good. So go to sunsetlakecbd.com. 420 is the coupon code. Get 30% off. All right. Like to welcome back to the program, Rich Yaselson. He is a member of the editorial board of Dissent Magazine. He worked in the labor movement for 23 years as a strategic campaigner. And he is returning to this program. I don't know if we see him yet. He is returning to this program. Hi, Rich. How are you?
Hi, Sam. How are you?
Well, I was just about to say that you're returning to this program, and I'm here with Emma Vigeland.
I am.
There. Hi.
Returning to this program, I think the last time we spoke was about maybe 8 years ago now, about you were writing about fortress unionism and a very different time in where the unions were at in some respects. In many respects, we have just sort of moved down there, but there's been a lot of different sort of things that have happened since then. And I want to circle back to that as we talk about what happened in Bessemer, but characterize for us. I think we had one of the organizers on this program, I don't know, 4, 5, 6 weeks ago. And there was a hopeful sense. And this was right after I think Biden had spoken out. Characterize for us just like the results, if you will. And then we will take it from there.
So the results were not obviously great. There were about 5,800 members of the unit, which is itself an important thing to discuss, how the unit sort of ballooned from 1,500 at the point when the union first filed its petition for an election to 5,800. And of that 5,800, perhaps 55% voted. There are about 500-600 votes that are still in dispute. Amazon mostly would, either side can challenge those votes. Amazon mostly challenged those. But of those votes that were free and clear, Amazon took about 70% and pro-union workers took about 30%. So, you know, that's a significant defeat in that there's a minimum requirement from the National Labor Relations Act if a union attempts to get an election that's supervised by the National Labor Relations Board, that they get 30% of the workers in the unit who sign cards and basically say, I'm interested in election. That doesn't commit them to vote for the election. It doesn't commit them to ultimately be a pro-union advocate, but it does say, yes, I'm in favor of an election. So essentially, the pro-union side, you know, ended up at the same 30%. And, you know, again, this is something to discuss in terms of how this all went down. But generally speaking, unions don't want to just petition for an election with 30%. Obviously, you need 50% plus one to win. But beyond that, because of the company tactics, which are, you know, the people who sign the checks have the most influence on workers. And because they have, the field is tilted overwhelmingly on behalf of the employer, it's not a fair fight. You know, unions generally, organizers I've spoken to generally want 60 to even 70% of workers signing cards before seeking an election.
All right. Well, let's. I want to circle back into that just so that people understand, because I think some of this stuff seems fairly Byzantine for people, and it is in many
sure.
respects.
Of course.
And we should say that practice of filling out the card to say I am interested in an election, like you say, it commits you to nothing. It just commits you to wanting to have an election, and there was an attempt. I guess it was like 13, 14 years ago, and there was a hope that the incoming Democratic majority in the Senate and House and in having the presidency when Barack Obama came in, that there was going to be a push for card check. And when we hear card check, that would have changed it from I sign a card to say I'm interested in an election to I sign a card to say I want to join the union. And there it's done and over with. Because that period of time between We signed the card saying we want an election, and the election provides an enormous amount of time for a massive company like Amazon to influence the outcome of the vote. And it's a war of attrition, and necessarily they have more power. I want to circle back to that, because then the conversation of the PRO Act. So, okay. So you've hinted at this, and when the union did the card, apply for a union, had people sign cards for this election. They thought the unit was one size, and it turned out to be another. Explain to us, like, what is this? What does a unit mean? And then walk us through what happened.
Well, a unit means what the National Labor Relations Board deems to be a bargaining unit, meaning bargaining is the key adjective there. In other words, these are workers that have enough in common with each other that when you put them all together, they would constitute an entity that, if they were to affirm the right to unionization, they would be entitled to collective bargaining rights. So that becomes, and this is very standard, this is nothing that Amazon had a superpower about. This is a standard company move. When a union signs up and says, okay, in this case, we have 1,500 workers in the unit as we define it, the company will try to do two things. A, dilute the union, the unit, by claiming many more workers have a right to be in it. In this case, in Amazon's case, they were already hiring an enormous amount of workers to deal with the COVID crisis. I mean, something like, you know, they almost increased by half their number of workers in the United States over the past year of the COVID crisis. So these are effectively where a lot of these workers were temporary workers, but they have been added all over the country, including Bessemer. Then there can be controversies about who is a supervisor versus who is a supervised employee. I mean, classic example of that is with a charge nurse. Is a charge nurse a supervisor, or is she just like the nurses that she supervises? She's obviously not a part of the management of the hospital, but doesn't mean that she doesn't not entitled to be in the bargaining unit. So in this case, Amazon said, look, we have all these people we think, they should be in the unit. In their case, they wanted supervisors to be in the unit. It can go either way. And all these temp workers. So what started out as 1,500, Amazon suit said, no, we've got 5,800 and we need to have a hearing before the National Labor Relations Board to adjudicate all of this. And of course, the purpose of a hearing is to slow everything down even more and create, you know, concern, anxiety, worry among the workers. In other words, you know, no rush to judgment. Nope. Make it bigger, dilute the activists like the organizer you had on your show, dilute their power, because their power in 5,800 is far different than their power with 1,500. And then slow the whole thing down. Let's have a hearing and talk about it. Amazon did this, you know, right out of the playbook. Companies all over the country do it. Obviously, they have more power and sophistication than pretty much any company, with a rare exception. But this is the standard play.
Now,
it was.
Go ahead.
Okay. Yeah, I'm just curious. Was there something specific to the Bessemer facility and just the workforce there that made them more susceptible to these kinds of slowdowns in terms of just Amazon's interference? Was there something about that specific Amazon warehouse that made them vulnerable to these tactics?
I don't think so. I mean, again, you really have to, you know, to be sure, you'd have to really talk to the organizers on the ground and the RWDSU, the Retail and Wholesale Distribution Workers Union, that organized it. But I don't think there was anything unique to that unit compared to, like, say, any other Amazon unit or really probably any other workplace unit that would make them susceptible. The thing is that structurally, the size of the unit changed enormously, and things slowed down. In fact, from what we could tell about that unit, the activists, the people who first got in touch with the organizing union, they're a strong lot. And they probably, in fact, a lot of them, from what you could tell from the reporting on the ground and also about Amazon, this is a big part of something to discuss here, was really excellent. That's like a silver lining that came out of this. We know a lot more about how Amazon does what it does. And it's the most emblematic company in all of what I called capitalist modernity, in a piece I recently wrote in Jacobin. So that's valuable. That's a silver lining here. We wouldn't have had that without this campaign. But, you know, Amazon did what it did and would have done it anywhere. But the actual activists, a lot of them came out of, from what we could tell, other union shops in the area. In fact, some of them were making even more than $15 an hour in other similar places. Amazon, you know, made a big claim, hey, we're at the Bernie Sanders rate. We're at $15 an hour, which was correct, you know. And some of them were in unions. And so the activists themselves really understood their own minds. The difficulty is that the activists themselves, it's not even, I mean, who knows? It's not even clear. They could have gotten the 50% with 1,500, although that would have been a lot more of a fair fight. We'll never know. But 5,800 changed the dynamic completely.
What is the best practice? And I know the answer to this, at least in terms of, like, you know, what you've written and what Jane McAlevey has written, which you cite in your piece as well. She has a piece in The Nation magazine. The best practices are that when you are faced with that type of, I guess it makes sense to me that, like, if I'm working at a place and there's 6,000 people who are doing a similar job to me, like, I wouldn't necessarily, there's no way for me to know that necessarily. I don't know. I'm looking around and I particularly from what I understand about working in Amazon, it's like, I work this aisle and that's it. Every day I work this aisle.
Work.
I have no idea. It's not like we all meet at the commissary at the same time.
Yes,
and we get ahead.
They're working with robots frequently. They're not even engaging with other human beings. It's very alienating work.
So I understand how they wouldn't, you know, this could come as a surprise, but what is the best practice for union organizers when you find out that a unit is actually three times the size, four times the size you thought it was, and you know that you're already starting with, a concentration of activists, and the fact that the unit is three times the size, you don't necessarily have intel or people on the ground or activists embedded in that other, you know, three-fourths of the unit. What's the best practice at that point?
Well, I don't think there necessarily is a best practice. There's just a strategic analysis that has to be made, sort of a power structure analysis, like evaluating the strength of the union, the strength of the worker activists that support the union versus the strength of the company. And it's more like there's a choice that's put before the union. And that choice happened in this case. And the choice was, you can go to once Amazon says to the National Labor Relations Board, oh, we want a hearing. Oh, this is not 1,500. Oh no, there's 5,800 people here. We can count them and we can show them to you. At that point, the union has a choice. It can go to the hearing and fight that. And then there'll be a delay, obviously, and discussion of that. And weeks go by. And while those weeks are going on, Amazon is incorporating its union busting strategy with group and individual meetings with the union, with the workers. And of course, keep in mind that the union doesn't have the right to go into the shop and sort of set up its own thing. And this would be like as if you had a presidential election. So you had, you know, Biden and Trump, and Biden wasn't allowed to go into, like, Trump's strongholds. So Biden couldn't go to Florida. You know, only Trump could go there, or vice versa. You know, Trump couldn't go to a Biden stronghold. So at that point, the union can either say, okay, we're going to fight this. We're going to try to reduce this number. We'll get it down to whatever they think is. We'll try to get down to 1,500 again. Or they can say, we're going to, the delay is our enemy. That's playing on the union, playing on the company's terms. So we're just going to go right into the fight and try to expedite the election as quickly as possible, despite the fact that we're overwhelmed here. And in other words, stipulate to the 5,800, which in this case is what the union did. Or the third choice is, we can't win this one now. Once they move to 5,800, we're doing our power structure analysis. It's awful for the activists. It sucks for us to have to pull back, but we can't win it. We just can't win it. And we're going to withdraw our petition now and try to extend our fight and build more strength and then fight another day. Those were the three choices.
There's also been criticism that I have read in various places. And some people were not on the ground. Some people were who have commented on this. But, reporters that I know who are on the ground, like you, or I read, who are on the ground, say there also wasn't necessarily the groundwork laid in terms of just an appreciation of what the union could do. Now, I know you weren't necessarily there on the ground either.
I wasn't.
And so it's hard to assess this. But broadly speaking, do you have a sense of whether this was, to make the decision that they made, which was option two, I guess, stipulate and go forward. You have to be pretty confident at that point. I mean, because, like you said at the beginning of this interview, most union organizers like to see 60 to 70% of a unit sign those cards. As you wrote in your piece, the idea is that you never gain when you're going up against these other four. Yes. You're never going to gain more supporters of the union. You're just going to try and staunch the bleeding of support until you get across the line. What can you, glean in terms of the groundwork that was laid for unionization there?
Well, let me say broadly, it was a new plan. So in other words, it was a year old. I mean, it's about a year old now. I think it was opened up, in March 2020. And so you've got a bunch of new workers. They don't know each other. It's not a quote unquote mature workforce at that plant. So what happens is that, or what apparently happened in this case is you have some activists, they want the union, which is great. Obviously, that's the foundation for everything. Without militant workers who actually want a union, given how hard it is to get one in the United States, more difficult than any other advanced country in the world by far, the most anti-union employer class by far. You have to have that. But when you have a plant where there's a bunch of new workers coming in, they don't know each other, they haven't worked with each other, it's more difficult to sort of pull them together into a cohesive majoritarian unit. Now, having said that, I think that's basically a secondary issue here. I think that becomes, criticism, whatever, it's fair enough. These are the people I've read, they're all smart, knowledgeable people inside the union, inside the labor movement or experts on the labor movement or really smart reporters. But I think that's kind of a sideshow. I think there's two fundamental issues here. One is the one we've discussed. Can you even do this at all once the unit is increased almost fourfold? Can you win, basically? And, do you accept delay? Do you go forward as I did and get beaten very badly? Or do you sort of say, better to retreat now and then build strength? Then the second more macro question is, can you organize a company like Amazon with starting in just one, even fairly large warehouse, when there's 110 warehouses in the United States? In 42 states, And there are 750,000, 800,000 workers. And so even at 6,000, mostly temps, we'll say, that's under 1% of the entire workforce of Amazon. So can you even do it this way? I mean, that's what the eminent, like the most eminent labor historian in the United States, one of the great historians, period, Nelson Lichtenstein, called trench warfare, quote unquote, in my home journal of dissent. So can you do trench warfare? In other words, if we're sort of talking about how they pull the unit together, we're talking about the nuances of trench warfare. And maybe trench warfare isn't even, I believe trench warfare isn't even the way to think about this.
All right. So this is an important point, because you cited in your piece the famous Flint, Michigan strike, which essentially unionized GM. And you compared and contrast based upon the number of workers at the Flint, Michigan plant in terms of what they represented. GM had the same sort of percentage equivalent roughly, to Amazon, yeah. Roughly. But their concentration of their workers was far, far more concentrated in four or five or six different places. And so when you unionized one shop, you have unionized a massive percentage, relatively speaking, to their entire workforce. And that fundamentally alters the equation. And so why is it harder to work? I mean, it may seem obvious to you, but I don't know if it is to most folks. Why is trench warfare harder in this instance?
Well, let me just step back very quickly to the GM example, because if anything, I undersold it in the piece, which I regret doing. And this is part of the brilliance of that strategy. And, you know, strategy and figuring out where the leverage points are is crucial for unions, given how difficult it is to pull any of this off in the first place, especially against emblematic companies like GM then or Amazon now. Yes, as I said, that was almost 25% of the total workforce of the company just in a Flint area, several Flint plants. But just as importantly, arguably even more importantly, GM couldn't make cars elsewhere without Flint. In other words, it wasn't just the number of employees. It was that like all the engines for, I think, Chevy cars came out of the Flint plants. It's that most of the tool and die, sort of the template for establishing each car, most of the tool and die work came out of those like interrelated Flint plants. So in other words, they could stop the whole company and control almost 25% of the workers, but also effectively stop the whole company from producing cars there. There isn't one given Amazon warehouse where that's possible. So to answer your subsequent question, you can't leverage the company's distribution of its product with just one plant. And B, you're hoping, and you know, maybe I'm not sure if this is true or not, to be honest, but maybe in the era of social media, there's a possibility this is true. You're sort of hoping that there'll be like a sort of a spread like wildfire effect, where activists in other units will be inspired by the victory in the first unit. But at 110 facilities, and not including the 75 elsewhere, which enables them to keep going all over the world, the 75 other warehouse distribution centers, like to sort of bet on that, I don't think it's a good bet. Like, I understand the activists on the ground want that, and that's why it's a complicated equation for the union and for the labor movement generally. So I'm not being particularly critical. I'm just saying this is a very hard calculation to make, and I don't think you can pull it off doing a trench warfare. Okay, we've got Bessemer, and now we move to Sheboygan, Wisconsin. I don't know if there's one there.
Right.
Now we move to Omaha, Nebraska. And, you know, I don't think that's an effective a likely effective strategy. Let me put it that way.
So how do you establish a national strategy then, right, where there's coordination? Is it the difference in the union representation, or, you know, what, like, a stronger, like, larger national union, or what is it?
Well, sure. I mean, that helps. I mean, with the UAW in 1936, 37 in Flint, the UAW itself was very small at that time. It had maybe 25,000 members, 30,000 members, but it had the United Mine Workers Union of John L. Lewis and the about to be newly formed CIO unions behind them. And John L. Lewis didn't just have a lot of clout through the mine workers, who really were fully organized and controlled, like, you know, 60% of the energy in the country at that point, which is far, far cry from what mining, coal mining does today. But he had a bank, the National Bank of Washington, and he had a lot of money to spend on organizers and all that. So they had that. So sure, one part of it is you need like a kind of a really large union, probably a strategically savvy union. Obviously, the full support of the rest of the labor movement to the extent that's possible, the logistics of that, where the unions have to work together on this common project. But then you also need, and again, this speaks to, again, the Flint GM comparison, you need to understand the leverage points. So there's like a top-down strategy. So you also need to have, in other words, people looking at like the whole company business model. Like, where is the company vulnerable in a regulatory sense? Where is the company vulnerable legislatively? Where is bad, you know, just intense media scrutiny, which I think can be overestimated in terms of its impact on people who are just determined to block unions, because they can ride out a lot of bad publicity as opposed to things that really concretely cost them money or stop production, like in the Flint example. But still, where is like constant scrutiny for a branded product like Amazon essentially is? The Amazon brand is essential. Like, where is bad publicity there actually going to like have a national effect? And then you're trying to like sort of do what's described as an air war and a ground war at the same time. Well, Bessemer was clearly an example of the ground war.
Right.
But you have this air war, and then you hope that, sure, there'll be activists in facilities all over the country, so your ground war also expands.
Well, I mean, the point of Amazon not having basically a linear supply line in the way it structures its business, where GM did. And in fact, we had a couple of guests on a couple of years ago. I've cited this book many times, called Wrecked, which talked about how the car industry specifically went to change their supply lines to, you know, more like on demand supplies, as opposed to for that very reason, to disempower a small shop from shutting down the entire production line.
Right. Or and, even a large shop like Flint.
Or a large shop. But you know, you don't want some outfit that employs 15 people and making ball bearings that if they stop, your whole production stops. And
of course, by then, of course, the UAW had already organized GM. So, you know, then you're just talking about how effective strikes are. But the organization had been done. In this case, of course, the challenge is to even get in the door and organize.
So if that's the case, I mean, if trying to figure out like where it is, like what group of people could be unionized that could actually seriously handicap Amazon's business model, at least, you know, not the servers, maybe the servers, that's where they make a lot of their money, particularly before this past year, frankly. I want to just turn to another thing that you sort of touched on in your piece, which was that we have laborism without the labor. It's talking about what, you know, on the same day that I talked about Bessemer, The tech people at the New York Times had unionized, or had talked about their, the Brookings Institute had unionized.
Right.
And that's like, that's great. But it's also like, as you write in your piece, that's not enough. But is there, like, how important is this sort of like quasi white collar or white collar unionization? You know, in terms of, because if I'm going to, if I want to shut down Amazon, I'm going to do it. I'm going to stop servicing their servers. I'm not going to do any of the sort of, I imagine the tremendous amount of like, work that has to go on to make the site function. I mean, if I want to shut them down in that way, right?
Right. So a couple of things. The laborism issue. Yeah, this is something I've been thinking about and I've written about for 5, 6, 7 years now. And as essentially, I do believe it's ideologically very important. I mean, in fact, you could argue that the Biden video, which I think is a very important document, FDR never came close to ever affirming unionism in that way. There were like apocryphal statements attributed to him, but he never did anything like that. And that video, because of modern technology, can be used in organizing campaigns as long as Biden is president. It went way beyond Bessemer. It affirmed the right of industrial democracy, workers choosing their right to self-organize. But what you've got is, right, people like yourself, like me, like all of us, not all of us, but many people probably watching this, who are, you know, mostly urban, mostly cosmopolitan, mostly college educated or more. And post the 2008 recession, frequently youngish. So, and post the 2008 recession, these folks felt like they're being squeezed in the new media. They're being squeezed in academia and in nonprofits. And they start to both affirm unions as an ideological commitment, like unionism, labor is good, but also saying in our own workplaces, that, and that's where everybody starts. So there's nothing wrong with that. Your own workplace, we're going to organize. The thing is, like the Brookings example is a classic one. Like Brookings, those workers were actually citing reports against Brookings that Brookings had written supporting unions. So they're saying, hey, you guys, hey, you eggheads here, you intellectuals, actually we're intellectuals too, but that's fine. We're all eggheads here. You guys are supporting unions. Hey, but don't you do that for your own shop? Don't you do that for this workplace? That's obviously not something that the average Amazon worker can do, or the average at the Amazon workplace. That's not something, in other words, that kind of jujitsu, rhetorical and ideological jujitsu, most workers can't pull off. So like on one hand, it's a very important thing. On the other hand, you might be right about the servers, but broadly, you have to sort of think what could pressure them. That could be one thing. Again, Nelson Lichtenstein, who I mentioned before, at a Washington Post piece I linked to about antitrust action against Amazon, comparing it to what happened with A&P during the New Deal era and beyond in the 1940s, basically saying, hey, you know, basically Congress people sort of saying, oh, A&P is basically screwing local shops, local markets, local stores by, you know, pricing them out of the market because the local stores can compete with A&P. So so then the unions get involved and sort of say, hey, here's the deal. You either get your whole company busted and decomposed by Wright Patman and the congressional people on his side in Congress, or you organize unions with us. And then we, the unions, will actually oppose the antitrust actions in return. So the workers got organized, and A&P kept its you know, not a monopoly, call it oligopoly. So in other words, that's a kind of laborism too. It's basically like an ideological advance guard, and bless them, this is great. They're workers too, of more, you know, cosmopolitan, more urban, more educated workers, the graduate students at Harvard, the New Yorker writers, or New Yorker editors, I guess, and editorial assistants are organizing. I mean, these are the kind of shops, as you say, Times High Tech. They just, it's just different than GM in 1930 or United Steel in 1936, 37, or Amazon or Walmart today. They're just not, you know, or FedEx. They're just not enormous enough to have weight in the economy, but there's still tremendous value in what they're doing, I think.
Give us a sense of now, like, okay, so let's just talk a little bit about the positives that have come out of this Bessemer thing. And let's talk about the PRO Act. And I mean, I think a lot of people are saying like this, you know, at the very least, this shows why you need a PRO Act. I don't know that the PRO Act would have made a difference in this specific case, but
It would have.
So, yes, I mean,
it absolutely would have, because Amazon would not have had the right even to go to the board to challenge the size of the unit. In fact, Amazon, the employers are cut out. The original intent of the National Labor Relations Act, and then it was revised in an anti-union direction by Taft-Hartley in 1947. The original intent in 1935 was that this is workers self-organizing. This is their organization. Like the Chamber of Commerce is the company's organization. Like companies don't have a right to even interfere. So they wouldn't have been able to interfere. They wouldn't have been able to argue that the size of the unit is four times. There would have been, according to the PRO Act, like they would have considered it. The board would have considered the union's petition in like 8 days, I think. And then there would have been a vote really quickly. I don't even know if the union could have won that vote. Maybe it would have, maybe it wouldn't have. But there wouldn't have been all this anti-union captive audience meetings, all the stuff that Amazon did and companies do. It just really would have happened really quickly.
You can't even requisition the $25 million that they were going to spend in right. 8 days, right? I mean, that's...
Yeah, right, exactly. So it would have had an enormous effect. The question is how to do it when you don't have a mass upsurge from the rank and file, the way what happened in 1934 led to the National Labor Relations Act of 1935, which, by the way, FDR was totally reluctant about. He had blocked it in the middle of 1934. This was like an unclear thing. Is this going to help me? I don't know. I'm not crazy about unions. But then all hell broke loose. There's a huge strike wave, militant strike wave, including deaths. I mean, San Francisco had a general strike. Four people died. 50,000 workers went through the streets, which is a lot of workers back then in San Francisco, with the caskets. Okay? Huge, huge fights all over. Ohio, Minnesota, truckers. So that pushed Congress and FDR off of his ledge. And so I said, yeah, okay, I'll let this go through and sign it in 35. So we're not going to have that this time. I feel safe in predicting. So I have to figure out a way, and sort of laborism is the way, sort of policy entrepreneurs who are kind of laborists, who sort of pushed Biden to do what he did, to sort of get to 50 Dems, and then we're now short, I think, four or five, to pass the PRO Act. So the plus here, to get back to that point you're making, the plus is, yes, all this coverage, it's true. That's why it's a complicated question regarding what the union strategy. It's true, if the union had pulled back, which I think on balance they should have done, because I think defeats beget defeat. But the plus side of them not doing it is that we got all this incredible coverage by media, both mainstream and leftist media, about Amazon and about these workplaces. And that coverage may help drive the PRO Act forward. So who knows? Maybe this terrible defeat will lead to something bad. I tend to think that terrible defeats are terrible defeats until something good happens, but
right.
Maybe something good will happen out of this.
I mean, like you say, the Biden, that Biden video is going to be deployed at various times throughout the year. And it could have
absolutely.
Been that, the context surrounding Amazon, you know, when Jeff Bezos, I know he's not necessarily the chairman now, but when he comes out and he's, you know, I can't even remember how many tens of millions, billions of dollars he's made over the past year.
I think it's like 110 to 180 or something like that. Maybe 70 billion, I think.
I mean,
who knows? Who's counting?
Exactly. At that point. Well, I mean, is there, we just have a couple minutes here, but is there anything that, that Biden can do short? I mean, are there not stuff he could do executive action that would at the very least, maybe, I don't know, pro-act light?
He can do stuff. I don't think this speaks to a larger issue, but it would be a tremendous model and it would help several million workers. This is something that labor has sought for about 10 years now. He can do something with companies who have contracts with the federal government,
right?
Which I think involves about 3 million workers, but I might be totally wrong about that, so I have to be confirmed. But obviously that's not every company, but it's a lot of companies. I mean, he can basically say that these companies have to be neutral, not fight unionization. Like let their, you know, come up with a, in order to get a union contract, a contract from the federal government to do business with the federal government, they have to permit unionization. In other words, they can't mandate it, but they have to let their voters free of fear and favor try it. So no captive audience meetings, no delay, no try to leverage it, no telling the workers constantly, even having bathroom messages in their face that the union sucks. He can do that. Those are executive orders that we know are before Biden's people. They were before Obama's people,
right?
Years ago, and somebody like Jared Bernstein, who's a key advisor to Biden both then and now, understands that stuff well. I think Ron Klain, who's been great in terms of working with the left, is probably the most powerful White House chief of staff since James Baker, understands that. So that's a key thing he can do. But the big thing is to leverage the PRO Act. Now he's trying to get the PRO Act to come through the infrastructure stuff. So that's attached to the infrastructure. I don't know if the parliamentarian will let that happen, right? But that was actually a pretty clever move, because then you only need 50 to pass the whole thing. And is Joe Manchin really good? Who is not a sponsor, by the way, West Virginia Joe, you know.
The only one, the only senator or Democrat.
I don't think that's, you know, what I've read, I think there's four. I think Angus King also isn't. I think Sinema isn't. We'll have to check. I think there's four or five, but they're almost there, but not quite. But yes, he's one of them for sure.
And Kelly. Well, all right, listen, we're out of time, but Rich, yourself.
And Kelly, yes.
The piece is in Jacobin. We will link to that at majority.fm. Really appreciate your taking the time to walk us through this. And hopefully we'll have you on sooner than 8 years from now.
Yeah, we still have to go back to fortress unionism.
I know.
Sam. So, we'll do that in 2029. So
fair enough.
All right.
We got to take a quick break. We got to take a quick break. We'll be right back after this. Okay, well, that's I would encourage you to read that piece in the Jacobin. Also, Jane McAlevey has a piece in the Nation, also worth reading. And of course, you can read Mike Elk. He has a great newsletter where he goes on the ground for a lot of these type of strikes. It's called Payday. You can Google that. Maybe we'll put a link to that as well. All of these great resources to find out more. And that's it for us today. Emma will and I will be back, or Emma will not be tomorrow. It'll just be me solo. So Emma, have a great extended weekend.
Thank you.
And we will see you tomorrow. unless we see you today.
And I have a doctor's appointment. It's not even that fun. Although my birthday is Sunday, so I just figured
what better way to celebrate your birthday than go see the doctor?
It's my annual checkup. Fun times.
Yeah, that's where you remember that you have it. It's right near your birthday.
I honestly, that's exactly how I do it. So
seriously?
It's a long story. My doctor's in New Jersey. I got to go to New Jersey for it. And so I scheduled around my birthday because if my mom doesn't see me around my birthday, she gets sad. So.
Oh, I understand. I can understand that as a parent.
Yeah.
All right. Well, you're going to head into the fun half. Just a reminder, it is your support, folks, that keeps the show alive. You can become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. When you do, you get the show, you support the free show. You get the free show free of commercials. And then you also get access to the fun half today, which is going to be featuring old Matt is going to show up for the fun half. And so make sure you check that out. Also, don't forget, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY. You get 10% off. And the AM Quickie every morning. Check out the headlines. 7 minutes. You will know everything you need to know for the day. Check out Nomi Show, the Nomi Key Show on YouTube, youtube.com/TheNomiKeyShow, or twitch.tv/the_NomiKey_show. Really just rolls off the tongue. And so check that out. Old Matt, what's the latest?
No mic, old Matt.
You have switched into the non-audio version of your show. Is that the latest?
Oh, my God. This is like, it's contagious today.
He's now bringing mime to Twitch, I think.
Folks, check out Doomed. Stick around. Matt will figure out his audio issues at the break. But this is a good time. If anybody wants to say anything to Matt, back talk. New Matt, what is happening in the Matt Leckian audio universe? Because Matt Leck is able to actually deliver some sound.
Yeah, tonight on Left Reckoning, Cale Brooks, Jacobit video editor on going from posting to politics. And also on that theme, the makers of the Reclaim Idaho documentary on Medicaid expansion Idaho. We're going to be talking about that great story that one of the positive stories from the last 4 years that will really get your spirits up. So check that out tonight, 8:00 Eastern, Left Reckoning YouTube channel. Go subscribe.
Old Matt?
About now.
Ah, there you go. What's happening, old Matt?
Well, hello, Sam and Emma and Matt and Brendan. Tonight at youtube.com/MattBinder, I will be doing a live stream with David Bixenspan, who brings us the news about, and wait for this, it's going to be shocking, yet another WWE wrestler brought into this world of far-right politics. But this time it gets even more interesting, where a former WWE wrestler turned mayor in Florida has now been wrapped up in this whole Matt Gaetz scandal. It is quite an interesting story, and I will bring it to you tonight at youtube.com/MattBinder. And if you don't catch the live version of the show, you can catch the audio version of the podcast shortly after at doomedpod.com.
There you go, folks. All right. These guys are going to head into the fun half. I will be back tomorrow. See you then.
Left is best.
Jamie and I may have a disagreement.
Yeah, you can't just say whatever you want about people just because you're rich.
I have an absolute right to mock them on YouTube.
He's up there buggy whipping like he's the boss.
I am not your employer.
You know, I'm tired of the negativity.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to upset you. You're nervous. You're a little bit upset. You're riled up.
Yeah, maybe you should rethink your defense of that, you fucking idiots.
We're just going to get rid of you.
All right.
But dude.
You
want to smoke this joint?
Yes.
Do you feel like you are a dinosaur?
Some good shit.
Exactly. I'm happy now.
It's a win-win.
It's a win-win-win.
Oh, hell yeah.
Now listen to me. 2, 3, 4, 5 times. 847-906-5014-57. 2, 38, 56, 27. 1/2, 5/8, 3.9 billion.
Wow.
He's the ultimate math nerd.
Don't you see?
Why don't you get a real job instead of spewing vitriol and hatred, you left-wing Limbaugh?
Everybody's taking their dumb juice today.
Come on, Sammy.
Dance, dance, dance.
Ooh.
Grandpa. I had my first post-coital scene with a woman. I'm hoping to add more moves to my repertoire. All I have is the dip and the swirl.
Fine, we can double dip.
Yes, this is a perfect moment.
No.
Wait, what?
You make under $1 million a year. You're scum. You're nothing.
Excuse me? Fuck you, you fucking liberal elite. I think you belong in jail.
Thank you for saying that, Sam. You're a horrible, despicable person.
All right, gonna take a quick break. I want to take a moment to talk to some of the libertarians out there. Take whatever vehicle you want to drive to the library. What you're talking about is jibber jab.
Classic. I'm feeling more chill already.
Good. Donald Trump can kiss all of our asses.
Hey, Sam. Hey, Andy. You guys ready to do some evil?
Hitler was such an idiot.
I think I might be a Nazi.
Agree.
No.
Death to America.
You.
Yes.
Wow.
Wow, that's weird. No way! Unbelievable. This guy's got a really good hook.
Throw our hands up.
Ooh. Wow.
But Sam, I gotta get off.
No worries. I wanna just flesh this out a little bit. I mean, look, it's a free speech issue. If you don't like me...
Hey, shut up!
Thank you for calling into the Majority Report. Sam will be with you shortly.